Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Our program today delves into the ethical dilemma over Uzbekistan, one of the world's most repressive regimes. Advocates for media freedom and human rights say conditions are getting worse under Islam Karimov's authoritarian rule. The last international monitor, Human Rights Watch, was evicted last year. Nevertheless, because of a simple fact of geography, the United States has decided to cozy up to the tyrants of Tashkent and restore military aid to Uzbekistan. Joining us today to talk about how this Central Asian country managed to become our vital strategic partner are Justin Burke and Joshua Faust. Justin Burke is the managing editor of a news website that covers Central Asian affairs, EurasiaNet, and Joshua Faust is a fellow at the American Security Project, and he's also a contributor to The Atlantic and a columnist for the PBS show Need to Know. We'll also hear portions of a recorded interview with the founder and editor of an Uzbek website, Daniil Kislov. Uzbekistan, to get a bearing on this, Uzbekistan shares borders with Kazakhstan to the west and to the north, Kyrgyzstan. Tajikistan is to the east, and Afghanistan and Turkmenistan are to the south. More to the point is the fact that their southern neighbor, Afghanistan, is, of course, in the middle of a war. So, Justin, could you briefly summarize why geography and geopolitics have made this former Soviet republic so important to the U.S. and its allies?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say thank you for having me and to talk to Uzbekistan's importance. Uzbekistan is in the center of Central Asia. And most importantly, it has a very well-developed or a relatively well-developed rail network. This makes it important for the American military because the Pentagon is now preoccupied with finding reliable routes to get supplies into the troops fighting in Afghanistan, both American and NATO troops. And Uzbekistan has a rail bridge at a city called Termez, through which much of the traffic now passes through supplies go and get to Afghanistan. That's because Pakistan has shut off another alternate supply route. So the bulk of supplies going into Afghanistan right now are going through Uzbek rails. There's also some air traffic, but Uzbekistan now is very, very important for the American war effort.
Right. And Joshua, I'm guessing that more people read this week about Uzbekistan's ban on Valentine's Day than about its role in the Afghan war. You know, what kind of country tells its people they can't celebrate Valentine's Day?
Well, actually, a number of repressive countries have told their citizens that they can't celebrate Valentine's Day. I mean, this is part of a broader movement in Central Asia of trying to crack down on influences or foreign influences on the local populations. Turkmenistan has influenced in the celebration of Valentine's Day. Tajikistan has gotten in the way of things like St. Patrick's Day and other kinds of Western holidays. So, I mean, it's unfortunate and it's annoying, and it's one of those stories that I think generates a lot of interest in the West because it kind of plays into the sense of these places being exotic and dangerous places, but there are actually kind of anodyne explanations and horrible explanations for why they're doing that.
Right. And you, so the United States stopped giving Uzbekistan money to buy military equipment in 2004 because the regime was repeatedly violating basic human rights. Right. And Joshua, you pointed out in an article in The Atlantic that Uzbekistan is now more repressive and less respectful of human rights than it was back then. And, but you also wrote that, quote, "It would seem like madness to reward Karimov's regime with military training and equipment." And you went on to write that the Western world has no choice but to do just that and form a security partnership with Uzbekistan. Why is there no choice?
Well, I think we do have to go back and revisit the 2004 decision to understand what's happening. Most of the way that people, especially human rights activists, view Uzbekistan today is through the lens of Andijan, which was the city in northeast Uzbekistan where there was an enormous massacre against anti-regime activists in 2005. This happened after the U.S. decided to cut off military supplies to the regime, but it's since kind of guided and constrained any kind of discussion about Uzbekistan. Now, with all that being said, the reason the U.S. is re-engaging with Uzbekistan is, I think Justin touched on it very well, it's because they're an alternative to Pakistan for supplying Afghanistan. And the relationship with Pakistan over the last 10 years has become so toxic and so destabilizing and so advantageous, frankly, to global terrorism that engaging with a madman like Islam Karimov does seem like a better choice compared to enabling all of the militancy and all of the military brinksmanship that accompanies the decision to engage with Pakistan.
Right. And Justin, Washington criticized Uzbekistan when it used deadly force back then to break up anti-government protests. And then the Uzbek government ordered U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, and which put a strain on the war effort in Afghanistan. Do you agree that turn of... Not quite.
What Karimov did was expel American troops from an air base, but that did not really have... That was an air base in Uzbekistan, but that really didn't have an appreciable impact on the war effort.
But did that lesson have an impact on our current policy?
I would say no at this stage. The thing I would like to say is there's always a choice, and there's always a danger of letting security always trump democratization concerns. American democracy, of course, is founded on a system of checks and balances. American foreign policy should also be balanced, and there is a security element to it and also a democratization rule of law element to it. And when one check cancels out the other, history shows bad things have happened. And so there's always a choice. We are basically right now soft-pedaling democratization concerns, fearful that if we raise issues, Karimov will, the president, Islam Karimov, will again try to kick us out like he did in 2005. I would say the situation right now is completely different now as opposed to 2005. Karimov needs us, I would say, just as much as we need him. Therefore, there is room to get tougher on him on a matter of democratization.
Right. Now, I think it's a good point to change gears here. Before we take a closer look inside Uzbekistan and the human rights situation, let's hear from dissident journalist Daniil Kislov. And also, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You also can find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to today's program on our website. So please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. The Committee to Protect Journalists reports that Uzbekistan is the leading jailer of journalists in Eurasia. The CPJ's count is 5, but Kislov said the actual number of journalists behind bars for offending the government is twice that many. Kislov is an Uzbek who moved to Russia and started the influential Central Asian news website named for his hometown, Fergana, 12 years ago. He tells Global Journalists that the state keeps a vice grip on the media inside the country. There are no really independent newspapers, magazines, broadcasters, or even internet news sites. No source, he says, that provides, quote, some sort of critical information on political or social topics in Uzbekistan. There are no accredited journalists in Uzbekistan from international news agencies, with two exceptions, the Russian news agencies Itar TASS and RIA Novosti. The Uzbek government has blocked the Fergana website inside the country, for the most part, and its correspondents in Uzbekistan have been attacked and harassed and denied accreditation. Several have been forced to flee and get political asylum in Europe. Kislov explained why they don't use the real names of their correspondents in Uzbekistan when they publish their dispatches.
In recent times, we practically don't publish stories from Uzbekistan with the real names of the authors. We absolutely either use a pseudonym, or we print our correspondent, or we say it's from our own source. This is happening especially in very recent times, because recently we have felt more pressure against our journalists. It's done for their safety.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, we're back. Sorry for that glitch there. He said that people are extremely scared that the government will punish them. And here's what he had to say.
Imagine the following picture. If you're not a tourist, but a regular person, a regular citizen of Uzbekistan, and you're walking in the streets and taking pictures of a building, in 5 minutes, an officer will come up to you and ask you for documents. And if you're not very cooperative, then you can be taken to the police station. And who knows what they'll do with you after accusing you of being a spy and saying that you're insulting the Uzbek people, and so on. What is work like for a journalist in this kind of environment? It's very difficult, but we try, although it's practically impossible.
And Justin, you're familiar with Kislov's work and the Fergana website. Could you discuss a little bit about the importance of that news outlet?
Well, there are many, many websites that are blocked in Uzbekistan, and his is one of the most important for getting information out to the broader public, because he has a well-developed network of reporters inside the country who are taking tremendous risks to get that information out. And one thing I'd like to add here, I actually in 2002 was taking a picture in downtown Tashkent and was stopped by the police, who confiscated the film.
Josh, are you familiar with the information flow inside of Uzbekistan?
Yeah, somewhat.
And kind of share with us just how iron-fisted this repression of the media is.
I mean, Uzbekistan definitely has one of the most repressive regimes on the planet. They are extremely restrictive of press freedoms, and the ability of even Western journalists to report out of the country is really tightly restricted. That being said, I mean, websites like Fergana.ru, I think, show that there's actually a rather vibrant diaspora community that doesn't have much of an effect inside Uzbekistan itself, but they're actually pretty good at smuggling information out and giving the outside world at least a vague idea of what's happening inside.
And Justin, let's talk about the economics a bit. GM has a huge auto plant in Uzbekistan, and now they've just opened up another engine assembly plant. My count was about 7,000 workers. Is that about right for employed by GM in Uzbekistan?
Yes, that sounds about right. But basically, Uzbekistan is a kleptocracy. It's a country where President Karimov, along with his friends, family members, and cronies, are treating the state treasury like a personal ATM, and they're monopolizing opportunity. Karimov's government has absolutely stifled completely the entrepreneurial spirit of small business entrepreneurs. It's very difficult now for an enterprising and resourceful Uzbek to start some sort of business endeavor and to encounter success. As soon as that enterprise becomes known to officials, it has a tendency to be sucked dry by corruption. Now, another important fact to keep in mind is that tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Uzbeks are labor migrants. There's not enough employment in the country, and they go abroad. They even go to Kazakhstan to find work in order to feed their families.
And tell us about the the annual conscription of children into Uzbekistan's cotton fields?
Well, that's a longstanding Soviet tradition. That's not necessarily something new that the Uzbek leadership has invented. Basically, at harvest time and during the planting season, school-age children, high school students, but some reportedly as young as 9, 7, are essentially drafted into labor battalions to go pick cotton. And they spend however long it takes, weeks, sometimes maybe even 2 months, depending on the level of the harvest. They spend it, instead of in a classroom, they spend it in the fields picking cotton, which is one of the major exports for Uzbekistan. It's a very important foreign currency earner for Uzbekistan. I believe Uzbekistan is the world's fifth largest cotton producer. So that and natural gas exports really keep the Uzbek economy afloat. There is absolutely no spirit of entrepreneurship in Uzbekistan right now. There's no middle class, no small business community, really.
And is there any economic leverage that the West can put on Uzbekistan?
Well, if anything, unfortunately, the United States right now has this northern distribution network that I mentioned earlier, which is partly the rail network, partly the air network, and the military contracts that are pouring into that are a gravy train for the Uzbek kleptocrats. Basically, Uzbekistan is a sinkhole of corruption. The U.S. Senate, late last year, when deciding whether to renew the ability of the U.S. to offer military aid to Uzbekistan, said specifically that the Pentagon should improve its oversight of military contracting along the northern distribution network. And basically, the risk is that the current policy, and which is basically a lack of oversight for military contracting, is helping to suck any sense of hope about the future out of the Uzbek people, because it is merely enriching the elite and encouraging the leadership to act with impunity.
And Joshua, are your reporters in the field finding a similar situation?
Well, I mean, I don't really have reporters in the field about that.
Well, Joshua Kuchera in his blog has written a good bit about this.
Yeah, I mean, the challenge in talking about, especially Uzbek's cotton industry, is that right now 60 countries, including the entire EU and the United States, are exercising a boycott on Uzbek cotton. But while they've been doing that, and this was actually something Eurasian reported, Russia, China, and India increased the amount of cotton that they're buying from Uzbekistan, so sending more money into their economy than ever before. So there are a lot of questions about how to actually begin addressing that kind of an economic disparity. I mean, I'm not interested in really defending the military's conduct in contracting, because they do have real serious issues with oversight and control. I think this gets back, though, at the point Justin made earlier when he was saying that the U.S. always has a choice. The problem with Uzbekistan is that there aren't a lot of choices. I mean, the only choice that the U.S. military, but then also, I mean, it's the government as a whole, has in this region is either using Uzbekistan to try to wind down the war in Afghanistan or using Pakistan to try to wind down the war in Afghanistan. The last 10 years of using Pakistan has resulted in an explosion of instability in a nuclear-armed state. It's resulted in this dramatic expansion of militancy, untold thousands of people butchered in the streets by terrorists. And I think when U.S. policymakers look at the choice of either going through Pakistan or accepting the costs of a temporary engagement with Uzbekistan, they think Uzbekistan offers a less bad deal, and that's kind of what they're stuck with. So, I mean, while all of these bad things do happen, and they need to be of concern, they need to be highlighted and constantly brought up as a cost of engagement, I'm really at a loss as to what other options they have.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about the threats of Islamic militants inside Uzbekistan. President Karimov said in a speech recently that the departure of U.S. and coalition troops from Afghanistan in 2014 will bring about, what he said, an increased threat of the expansion of terrorists and extremist activities, increased tension and confrontation. And that might create a permanent source of instability here. Justin, what do you make of those remarks, and what's the subtext, do you think?
Well, it's blatant hype to justify his own repressive policies. I can point to an episode late last year in which there was an explosion on a rail bridge connecting Uzbekistan to Tajikistan, and Karimov and the Uzbek government basically indicated that it was Islamic radicals who were responsible. Yet my website had a reporter who managed to get an eyewitness view of the bridge, and it seemed that it was done in such a way to disable it and not actually destroy it. And it would seem then that the Uzbeks themselves blew it up, and basically because they're mad at Tajikistan's government, because the Tajik government wants to build a dam that threatens to restrict water supplies that are needed for Uzbek cotton. And so it was a coercive effort to strong-arm the Tajiks into backing off the dam plan. More broadly, Islamic radicalism is definitely a concern, but the real source is the dire economic situation in Uzbekistan right now. If people have no hope about the future, they're going to look for simple solutions, and Islamic radicals are offering simple solutions to people's problems right now.
All right. Let's look forward then about what happens when the Afghan war ends. Joshua, what do you think? Look in the future and give us a prediction on what the dynamics are going to be after we don't have to use this supply route.
Yeah, I think that's actually the big question right now. I mean, the concern about Islamic radicalization, I don't think really can be written off the way that Justin writes it off. Karimov is probably overstating the problem, but Uzbekistan isn't the only country in Central Asia that's expressed a concern about this. Russia has, China has, India has, Pakistan has, even Iran has wondered about the destabilizing effects of a precipitous U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think we can't forget the fact that in the late 90s, the primary source of transnational terrorism in Central Asia was Uzbek. It was the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. They're still active in northern Afghanistan. They still haven't abandoned their publicly stated goals to overthrow the Karimov regime. So we can't just discount this as being impossible to happen. I think we can try to contextualize this and see what the actual threat is. It's not the end of the world. It's not going to be catastrophic, but there is definitely a threat. And I'd say a likely threat of increased violence. There are also other secondary effects that are going to come from the U.S. Withdrawal. I think the economic picture is a very interesting one. Right now, a vast majority of Afghanistan's economy is dependent on U.S. and international spending. In a recent Senate Foreign Relations Committee report, they said something like 97% of Afghanistan's economy ultimately comes down to payments by the international community. As that winds down, you're going to see an enormous economic crash in Afghanistan. You're going to see the same thing happening, frankly, in Uzbekistan, to a lesser extent Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan, as the U.S. stops paying so much money for transit fees and for access to these countries. That's also going to have substantial economic ripples that are going to have some kind of political effect in the area. I don't think we have a good handle of what those are going to be, aside from the fact that they will probably be major, but that they also probably won't be regime-shattering, because very little seems to actually shatter these regimes. But I think looking at the idea of how this is going to be affecting instability, and especially driving political instability, is a very, very interesting one.
Justin, what kind of money are we talking about? I know that our aid for non-military items is about $12 million annually. What kind of money are we talking about with the military supply route coming through there?
Well, we've been able to, through our investigatory work to determine that about it, we're talking about $500 million. But the Pentagon won't say where it's going. They won't break it down by country. So we don't know, for example, how much Uzbekistan is reaping, but it's likely the lion's share of that amount. It's enough to keep the Uzbek government happy for a long, long time. If I could peer into the crystal ball and take a look down the road after 2014, I worry that Islam Karimov may become the new Anastasio Somoza, who is the Nicaraguan dictator in the 1970s in Latin America. Now, I am not downplaying the threat of Islamic radicalism. What I'm saying is that the government itself is enhancing the threat through its economic policies, that with sounder economic policies, the threat would be minimized. But to follow on the Nicaraguan example, back in the 1970s, of course, we were fighting the Cold War and were interested in containing communism in the Caribbean and in Latin America. So we backed Somoza, who was a thuggish dictator just like Karimov. And that set off a chain of events that led to the Sandinista revolt culminated actually with the Iran-Contra scandal. And our unqualified support for a dictator in Nicaragua brought on the very thing that we were trying to prevent, which was the spread of communism. The same risk could exist in Uzbekistan, only you just exchange communism for Islamic radicalism.
Right. That's a pretty almost seems like an unsolvable dilemma, and that's why it's important to, I think, for us to keep a close eye on what's happening in Uzbekistan. I really appreciate you two for giving us some insight into this difficult issue. We've come to the end of this week's edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today were Justin Burke. He's the managing editor of a news website that covers Central Asian affairs, EurasiaNet. Joshua Faust is a fellow at the American Security Project and also a contributor to The Atlantic and a columnist for PBS Need to Know. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. Donovan Ferguson was our lead producer, assisted by Allison Pasek. Now, stay tuned for Free Press Watch. And join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, a segment on Global Journalist where each week we bring you a rundown of major events affecting press freedom around the world. I'm Lainey Mullen. Today's news comes from ABC News, the Committee to Protect Journalists, International Press Institute, and Reporters Without Borders. Defenders of press freedom say the government of India should improve its legal protection for journalists. In recent weeks, citizens have vandalized a newspaper office, postponed documentary film screenings, and pressed charges against a cartoonist. Two Brazilian journalists were killed last week. The first, Mario Lopez, was taken from his house with his girlfriend and shot. The second, Paulo Rodriguez, was shot while driving through town. Both journalists covered local corruption and politics. Journalists experienced a string of troubles in Indonesia this month. One was arrested, one was beaten, and one, Dharma Salan, was found dead near his motorcycle in a ditch. The autopsy showed he had received a blow to the head. For more information on these and other events affecting press freedom around the world, please visit our website at globaljournalist.org. Thank you for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Lainey Mullen. See you next week.